Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Bill Motlong from station WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin. Today, we're broadcasting part one of Charlie Noer's interview with former monk, Buddhist teacher, and translator, Santi Caro.
When we talked in 2012, you were recovering from cancer treatments and operations, and I began that interview with this question. What does suffering and the end of suffering mean to you in your daily life? You're currently less than a year out from another cancer treatment, and I would like to ask that question again. But before I do, if you could briefly explain what suffering or dukkha is.
There are numerous ways to come at the teaching around dukkha or suffering. One that's a good starting point and not limited to Buddhists is unnecessary distress, where things are happening in life, maybe not going our way, nasty illness or a conversation with someone's frustrating. These are just part of life. But when we make distress out of such events, the weather, the current politics, that unnecessary distress is suffering. Now, many people would question that it's unnecessary, and that gets into the so-called origin of suffering. But before we go there, there's a traditional image of this, which is a ox cart wheel that wobbles. The etymology of the word dukkha is when something does not rotate smoothly. There's grit caught in there, it's out of balance, out of whack. So suffering can be also seen as when our life is out of balance, out of harmony, off kilter, out of whack. We experience that as suffering, which applies to things, for example, going how we want them to. And we get so excited about that, we're almost drunk. That's dukkha as well.
But is suffering ever present? Is suffering a part of life that we should just simply learn to accept?
In the early teachings, the original word dukkha has a range of meanings. Based on context, though, what's appropriately translated as suffering or misery or being ill at ease is not necessary.
And so how does that fit into your recent cancer treatment, operations, et cetera? It seems like there could be lots of physical pain involved with that. And that could, for me, for example, produce suffering, what I would think would be suffering. But does it have to produce that suffering, or is there a way for me to mitigate that suffering?
I was fortunate there wasn't much pain. There were at times 15 years ago with my first go-round with lymphoma, but there was lots of fatigue, some nausea off and on, some vomiting, lots of discomfort, not so much pain. But I know many people equate pain, illness, etc., with suffering. But I don't. Illness, discomfort, fatigue is suffering when I take it personally. It's suffering when it's mine. I am having this. And within that is some pushback. I don't want this. I don't like this. And that creates me. There's an identity. There's someone I think I am. And I take it personally. So there are a lot of things that more or less I wasn't taking personally. These machines, I went through stem cell transplant. The process of collecting stem cells is being hooked up to a machine, a lot like dialysis. And it's weird, not particularly painful, but kind of weird. Is this me? Not necessarily. To common sense for most Americans, that may not make sense. I'm not laying there in the bed saying it's not me. It's just there's this machine doing its thing. There are nurses checking. There's all kinds of sensations, sounds. I could also watch a movie while it was going on, read a book. There's all these things happening, none of which need to be taken personally. In the early teachings, the original word dukkha has a range of meanings. Based on context, though, what's appropriately translated as suffering or misery or being ill at ease is not necessary.
It feels like an immense amount of practice on your part to put those things into perspective. I hear what you're saying as there is suffering, but it's not my suffering. How does somebody get to that point of being able to see things in that perspective?
My understanding, which aligns with the early or original Buddha's perspective, is such things are suffering. Pain, discomfort, loss, aging, illness, these are all part of life. That doesn't make them suffering. It's suffering because we don't like them. We don't want them. The suffering is in the dislike and wishing them to be otherwise. And that wishing creates the me that identifies my suffering. It's not suffering without the my.
And how does that, what could be suffering, transform into you to some sort of equanimity?
Equanimity is part of what's left. When the judgments, reactions that cause suffering fade, dissolve, cool away, what's left is just life, alive, heartbeat, breathing, sensation, and there's an emotional balance, which could be called equanimity. There's a calmness, an inner spaciousness. And Buddhism understands that as what's normal. That's normal. In our Western medical model, we have not normalized health. The big money is elsewhere. But for the Buddha, what is normal is inner peace, spaciousness, balance, which is also naturally kind and sensitive.
That really makes me want to go to this question. Knowing that you were a monk for 19 years, but at some point there was a start to your interest in it. What was appealing about Buddhism?
Honestly, I don't quite remember back in college. But something that I remember clearly was towards the end of my Peace Corps service in Thailand, which was when I was more and more exposed to living Buddhism. It wasn't just from books. I was meditating off and on, and I picked up a little book by Ajahn Buddhadasa, who a while later became my teacher and still is. And the book really hit home at selfishness. And that hit me pretty strongly. Here I was in Peace Corps, supposedly doing good, helping people in rural Thailand. And mostly, I was a good school teacher. I was doing some helpful projects in local villages. I was considered a good, successful volunteer. But my interest in Buddhism at that time helped me to see my motives weren't always pure. I've been a competitive person for a long time. There's an opinionatedness. I would read stuff and go, that's cool. That's what we gotta do. And I was successful at finding people who would let me do these projects. And some of them did seem to have genuine benefits. But I saw my pushiness as selfish. And that tarnished just the fun of being out in villages with really nice people, having cool, what to some here in Wisconsin might seem exotic experiences. It was a sugar cane growing area. And once I was driving the school motorcycle home, and I went through a puddle of sugar cane juice mixed with the clay soil of the road. And I was just covered, and it was hot, and this reek was pretty disgusting. But that was part of the life. Mostly I enjoyed zipping around on the motorcycle. It was also a banana growing area, a special kind called egg bananas, quite tasty. So usually I had some bananas on the handlebars because somebody gave me some bananas to take back to school. Anyway, there was a lot of just wonderful stuff, interacting with people, learning, but my self-centeredness tarnished that. That was what really engaged me with eventually ending up at Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery. I want to understand this. And I should also say, I had been working in the Thai school system for three and a half years. Some of my colleagues were not exactly dedicated to helping their students learn. And I would get outraged and upset and be critical. So much so I caused too much trouble at my first school and was moved to a second school where I knew better to keep my anger under control. So I was also seeing how things in society, the secondary school system, but I was also working with the local vet, the local ag extension person. The theme of selfishness I saw, and more or less still do, is what causes our problems in societies, whether over there or what we're going through here today. And I wanted to understand selfishness. What is this thing? And so that led me deeper and deeper into Buddha's teachings and practice.
I'm having this wonderful picture in my mind of you meeting Ajahn Buddhadasa at the monastery and displaying the kind of behavior that you just talked about and thinking about how he might suggest corrections to that behavior. Did that happen?
Yes. My critical mindedness would find things that I thought were wrong. And after a while, I wasn't afraid or ashamed to complain. And he never told me what to do about that. But what he did ultimately was more effective. He did not react. And more quickly, as this would repeat this bad habit of mine as a young, opinionated American monk who thought he was smart, even though I deeply respected him, but there were others I didn't respect so much. He just sat there, maybe nodded. He did not frown. He did not smile. He just sat there, and there was no reaction. Most people react. There were people in the monastery who would agree with me, people who would argue with me. He didn't do either, nor did he judge. He just sat there. And after a while, I would become increasingly self-conscious of my unwholesome mental, emotional state.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. We return now to Charlie Noer's interview with Buddhist teacher and translator, Santi Caro.
Unwholesome's a key word in Buddhism. One of the basic discriminations in wisdom or discernments is between what's wholesome, what's unwholesome. Kindness is wholesome. Genuine kindness. Self-centered masquerading as kindness is manipulation. That's unwholesome. And his non-reaction increasingly allowed me to catch what was going on in me. I think most of us have these old habits, some of which go back to childhood, some of which go back to trauma, and they're more or less addictive, not like certain substances, but the emotional energy. We just react with little self-control. Sometimes there's enough awareness, we bottle it up, and it churns away inside. So his non-reaction would allow me to catch the somewhat addictive energy, in this case of my annoyance, criticalness, and anger. So catching the ugliness of it and the pain, that's the dukkha part. The emotional, psychic pain, distress of such things. And as I stopped spinning with it and things would calm down, then he would talk about it and we would discuss some relevant teachings after I calmed down enough to have an intelligent conversation.
What was your daily life like when you were in the monastery? And how quickly did you learn? What was the learning process?
Suen Mok was a monastery set up for mature people in Ajahn Buddhadasa's eyes. So he didn't spend much time, at least while I was there at the end of his life, telling people what to do. There were certain regular activities, morning chanting at 4:30, evening service at 6. There would be public talks by him and others, eventually including me, and there was work to be done. Mostly, we were free to chart our own course. As monks, there's a training discipline that we vow to follow, some places more strictly, some less. And then there were lots of cultural expectations for monks. So as long as you didn't violate any of that too much, you had lots of freedom. And I did. So I joined in morning and evening chanting for a while. But just before I got there, monthly meditation retreats for foreigners were begun by the assistant abbot, and I was put to work helping, and over time became in charge of that. And then we also had people who stayed between these 10-day retreats. So my work was looking after the foreigners, organizing talks, answering questions, leading meditation sessions. But because I spoke Thai quite well, I was popular with groups like school kids. They can hear a talk from the American monk or activist groups, university students. I still had a small hut to go back to, meditate in the morning, the evening. During the day, if I didn't have other things to do, I would read. I loved to read. And there were plenty of books in English and Thai. And also, I began translating. I often had small translation projects.
From there, you became, at least back in the States here, when you got back, you became a Buddhist teacher, still are. You make trips every year to different locations to teach. You became a translator. Have most of your translations been of Ajahn Buddhadasa's Dharma talks?
All of them.
Do you have one planned?
There's this one book Ajahn Buddhadasa asked me to translate, and I've survived 2 bouts of serious lymphoma. So I'm thinking before the 3rd one, I think I should translate this book.
And broadly, what's the topic?
The title, which is a Thai-Sanskrit hybrid, Kaivalya Dhamma, means the truth of wholeness or the reality of everythingness. And Ajahn Buddhadasa intended this as a reaching out to other religious traditions. He talks a lot about God, both Christian and Muslim. Southern Thailand had a small but important Muslim population, including in that area. And also the word Kaivalya is important in other Indian traditions, interpreted differently. He explains it in lots of ways. It's a 400-page book, and it's a way of seeing life as, you could say, he wouldn't quite say it this way, everything is one. More, everything is within this whole.
That makes me think of this question. Is Buddhism a religion? Is there a deity?
Not like in Christianity.
But does that define a religion?
Some people think it does. Mm-hmm. We're in the U.S., and there's an old history of colonial arrogance and Christian missionaries who treated Buddhism pejoratively because Buddhism did not worship the one God. And so what has happened, and still in this culture, it still lingers a bit, I think, in the academic study of religion, that a notion of religion based on Christianity is the lens that Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism are viewed. Ajahn Buddhadasa would address this in various ways. Buddhism's a science in certain ways. It's a philosophy which originally the word meant love of wisdom. Sophia is wisdom. And Buddhism's an art. Currently, I would say it's a way of life. But I would say all religions ought to be a way of life more than a belief system.
It's probably a way of life in an Eastern country, in Thailand, for example, where, I don't know, I think you could argue it's the state religion, isn't it?
Constitutionally, no. Conservatives want to make it the state religion. More progressives think that's a bad idea because Muslims, Christians are maybe 1% of the population, plus some Hindus and Sikhs. Buddhism is enshrined quite a bit in official life. Buddhism isn't so much a creedal religion. It's full of teachings. There is, on a cultural level, some expectations of behavior. Thailand is now within the capitalist web. And just like here, I would say capitalism is the dominant value system, not Christianity.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to part one of Charlie Nowra's interview with Buddhist teacher and translator Santi Caro. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact Ursula Rudenberg at ursula@pacifica.org. This show was produced at WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, by Charlie Noer and yours truly, Bill Motlong. Inspiration by Tamara Dean. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts when we air part two of this interview.